Warning, Star Trek From the Holodeck contains adult language and discussions. If you're easily offended, do not continue to listen.
Lock it alone!
Fire.
Holodeck 3 program is reinstated.
Open sesame!
Commander Klingon vessel. We are energizing transporter beam. Now.
Okay, hello, welcome everyone to Star Trek From the Holodeck. Reman Digital's exclusive Trek theme series. If you're new to our podcast, you can find all of our shows past, present, and in the future wherever you listen to podcasts. Just search From the Holodeck. Okay, so how are you today, Dave?
I am fantastic. I'm actually feeling good that we are here getting our final season of Discovery started.
Yeah. So we've returned from a very long hiatus.
A
much needed hiatus. We were very busy the past year with a lot of Star Trek shows and a lot of content that we had put out both for free and over on our Patreon page. But as I promised to our loyal listeners, or maybe listener for all I know, maybe it's just one really excited fan of our show.
It's that one Discovery fan that basically is spearheading the fan base. Yeah,
we're like the only Star Trek podcast that likes Discovery, it seems like. So, you know, and there's only one Star Trek fan that seems to like Star Trek Discovery. Hey, never say we don't do our part for the Star Trek fandom.
Exactly.
So we've returned in order to send Discovery off into Star Trek history with this final season. We started doing this show, if you remember, we started doing this show several months before Discovery aired its first season, and we had even put together this podcast in large part to celebrate Trek's return to television.
Yep.
So our show has paralleled Discovery since 2017. Now, we were doing things prior to that, like I said, but we knew Discovery was just around the corner when we had started our show. That was the reason why we started the show.
Oh, yeah.
I know Discovery has been a point of debate and has been a divisive series for a lot of Trek fans. However, that's bound to happen when you have a show that wanted to take risks like Discovery has. It also suffered a bit from indecisive management and eventually strained out by season three when it found its own identity and it no longer relied on past iterations of Trek exclusively for its plot and narrative. This series will be, in my opinion, David, it will be fertile ground in years to come because it has way more to offer in the way of the sociopolitical than any of the newer Kurtzman era Trek.
Oh, yeah, because the one thing that I will always give Discovery is this series will go down as the one series that always tried to push the envelope in regards to Star Trek.
And even politically, if you look at Strange New Worlds, they're not really doing much politically. Certainly, they're making those much needed nods, but they're making small steps. Deep Space Nine, Voyager, TNG, and Discovery make broad strokes when it comes to dissecting and, I guess, presenting social commentary of sorts to listeners. So that, I believe, will be missed. At least I will miss that. But my point is that when historians, you know, film theorists go back and start digging through the archives of Star Trek, there's going to be a lot more there for Discovery, or I should say in the way of Discovery for these scholars and film theorists to dig through.
Oh, absolutely. Because like people have actually, ever since Discovery made the announcement that this will be their final season, Star Trek fans now are comparing Discovery to other series. And people are like comparing like those trolls out there saying, oh, it's the worst series of all time, worse than Enterprise. But if you compare Enterprise and Discovery, Discovery really has a lot of ground that it covered. More so that basically, just like what you said, us fans will be able to look back at Discovery and all their seasons and pull things out of it.
Yeah. And that's not to say, as I mean, I don't want people to think I'm shitting on the new stuff, Picard and Strange New Worlds, because, you know, they have also, like I said, done their part in ways of social commentary and dissecting the problems in society. But intellectually speaking, Discovery has more to offer scholars and film historians to sift through other than the two so far.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because to me, and I agree with you, I'm not saying anything bad about Strange New Worlds or Picard.
No, not at all.
I've enjoyed all of pretty much everything Star Trek has given us these past years. But what I will say is the difference between Discovery, Strange New Worlds, and Picard, to me, Picard and Strange New Worlds were a safe bet. I always look at them as basically, oh, that is comfort food. That's basically something a fan can fall back on. You can turn it on, leave it on, and just enjoy the ride. Discovery is the one that makes you think. A lot of like the stuff they do in Discovery that I really do appreciate is they're not afraid to tackle narratives or story arcs that some other shows would absolutely treat like the Black Plague and just run away from.
I think in a lot of ways, David, and listen, Deep Space Nine is a superior Star Trek series in almost every way. But in a lot of ways, Discovery parallels the rise of Deep Space Nine and what it has to offer in the ways of socio-political text. Now, Deep Space Nine is a better example of how you write a very tight series. But Discovery also went into that similar territory that created a divisive spirit amongst many Star Trek fans, because they were attempting to do what Deep Space Nine did, offer something different.
Yes.
And by doing that, when you're a part of a very large IP with a very big, extensive history, taking risks sometimes doesn't always work well for the large bulk of the hardcore elite fans, because let's be honest, many of us, we like what we like, and oftentimes we want what we like, and we are closed off to the possibilities of the new because it's new. That's very normal. That's very much a part of us as humans. We are comfortable with the things we understand.
Yeah. And the thing is that I've noticed too, is kind of like, Discovery, out of all the other shows, has created discussion. That's the thing that I really do appreciate. Looking back at Discovery, you may not agree.
Also, some shootouts. Some people have done some drive-bys.
Yes. And that has been a lot of people have been doing drive-bys on this show.
Let's also remind people that this isn't just Discovery that did this. For our young listeners, they may not realize that Discovery is not the first show that generated a lot of toxic hate.
Yeah.
Deep Space Nine also did a lot. And this is pre-internet.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that's
or pre-social media, I should say.
And I think that there's a difference between this toxic talk compared to, like, say, like when you talk about the toxicity around, like, say, like a show in Star Trek's history, like Enterprise, there's different toxicity. I think that basically shows like Deep Space Nine and Discovery, what they're able to do is create discussion. Enterprise, as much as I enjoyed Enterprise, I also understand that Enterprise just created a toxic attitude towards Star Trek.
It's just the time that it came out. The
time it came out, it was poor timing and it was poor.
People were losing interest in the Star Trek shows.
Yeah. It was behind the eight ball.
Mm-hmm.
So that type of toxic behavior can kill a franchise. But this type of toxic, where it basically creates a discussion, is able to push a franchise forward. I mean, some of the concepts from Deep Space Nine have carried on more so than any some of the concepts brought up in TNG.
Yep. And if I was Ira Steven Burr, I'd be so fucking annoyed.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Part of me would be happy. But also part of me would be like, thanks, guys, for giving me zero fucking credit on nothing. Not even a shout out.
Well, that do you realize that is the one thing I cracked up at looking after watching the famous documentary of What We Left Behind? And Ira Steven Burr just basically takes it on the chin and basically says, I'm glad that there's still a fan base. But I mean, lot of those guys still harbor ill will.
Even Picard's third season, the best season of Picard, was built on the back of Deep Space Nine.
Deep Space Nine, yeah. Do you realize that? Like the storyline for Star Trek for Picard season 3 was a continuation of not even a TNG concept.
Yeah.
It was a concept of Deep Space Nine.
Even the Mirrorverse stuff.
Deep Space Nine.
You had the Mirrorverse episode, yes, from the original series, but it was not what it ended up becoming. What made it what it became was Deep Space Nine. Enterprise then took those nods and ran with it. Discovery took those nods and ran with it. So it's always Deep Space Nine. Always. When you look at some of the greatest ideas, Voyager is built off of Deep Space Nine and TNG a bit because of the Maquis.
Yes.
So, all right. So let's start with our official discussion here now that we got through the excitement and the celebratory talk. So synopsis for this episode titled Red Directive, Captain Burnham and USS Discovery are sent to retrieve a mysterious artifact hidden inside a 800-year-old Romulan vessel, but find that they're not the only ones on the hunt. Meanwhile, Saru is offered the position of a lifetime. The first thing I noticed from the very beginning was the difference in tone. The series has seemingly shifted, and this is something you and I have talked about, just continually throughout the last couple years. The series has shifted the vibe of the show. This will now be the third time.
Yeah.
In its short 5-year run. And we will see if this tonal shift, in fact, will pay off by the end. Traditionally, David, I'm not the biggest fan of these types of habits because tonal shifts are typically marks of an indecisive writing room. But I will reserve my judgment until we get to the end.
Yes.
Because I did like the episode quite a bit, but it was a stark contrast.
Oh, yeah. That's what I took apart as well. Is like, this did not feel... The first episode of Discovery's last season didn't start as the atypical Discovery episode. You didn't even get, like, the quote-unquote intro monologue that they did all last season with Burnham talking in the captain's log type of monologue. Here you get like almost like a Strange New Worlds, like action right away, bang, it just happens, and then here's a flashback. We'll cut to a flashback to explain how we got here, and it definitely took me off guard. But in a lot of ways, after I watched the episode, I started seeing this tonal shift as if they tie this tonal shift with the growth of this crew. Like, Burnham started this as a very hesitant, not sure of herself type of captain personality. Here, we get right out of the gates that Burnham is this action, you know, swashbuckling type of captain now. She will jump into the fire. She's earning her captain's badge at this point. And she's entering the maturity that we expect out of a captain, like Captain Kirk and Captain Picard, who you're the leader of the ship. You are supposed to take actual, hold of everything now.
I'm wondering it would be an interesting project to perform, but I think this is the only Star Trek show where the tone of the series itself matches the tone of the lead.
Yes.
So, for example, the beginning, dark, existential,
mysterious,
lost. That all matches Burnham. The second season, same thing. Her relationship with Spock, fleshing that out, them having to say goodbye. It's an end of an era. There's a bits of melodrama there. You go into season three, Burnham's now dealing with the loss of her family, Spock, Georgiou, gone out of her life.
Yep.
So it all works with how the character's supposed to be feeling. And I do like that when TV shows do that. But again, I don't think we'll be able to fully judge whether or not that was a good thing to do until years down the road, when we go back and do our rewatches and see, well, okay, now that we've created some distance, does this actually work or does it hinder the show? Now, to your point, one reason why season three's tonal shift, this is my justification for it, because as I was saying, the tone of the series itself matches our protagonist's mood. Well, then a lot has changed over the last several years. She is more confident. She's more secure. She's in command. She's not dealing with immediate loss.
Yeah.
So her mood would probably be a lot lighter. So that would then justify the tonal shift for season five. So in that respect, it does work. But again, it's one of those things that you're not going to be able to fully judge until, in my opinion, either by the end or years later down the road.
Yeah.
Okay, so interestingly, this episode was more or less an episode designed to sort and situate. Michelle Paradise, the showrunner herself, did not waste a lot of time and really just catapulted, as you had mentioned, David, the audience right into the action. It was more or less reminiscent of Trek's earlier swashbuckling hijinks, as depicted in the opening moments with the introduction of Maul and, I believe, Lack. What is up with all these Lack names? Are we putting apostrophes now and just fucking up the language?
You have to make it sound almost Klingon.
Yeah. The introduction of Maul and Lack and the subsequent chase, which that chase scene was really cool. And it might have been some of the coolest things we've seen in Discovery to date. The thing I like the most about being in this era of Star Trek is that the writers can come up with really interesting concepts that are not capable when crunched between eras of canon. Whereas this era liberates them, allowing them to write or come up with really intriguing ideas pertaining to, you know, fictional Trek technologies. You know, seeing Maul and Lack's device that, penetrated the hull of the Romulan ship. And then the vacuum of space whisking Burnham out into space, where she then activates the instant, like, Iron Man-like spacesuit.
Yeah.
I mean, it was cool and it was exciting. It felt like I was watching it, not a Star Trek series, but a Star Trek film. It was very cinematically exciting.
Well, not only that, even down to the effects, like, it wasn't just the fact that Laak and Maul basically produced essentially a bomb to cut through the Romulan ship. They created a singularity, which was amazing seeing visually, because it wasn't just a bang or a flash or anything else like that. They added the dimensions of actually showing, no, this is a singularity happening, like a mini black hole just happened, just in a fraction of what would happen in doing that. And I think that basically this is one of the strengths from last season of Discovery, where they really started thinking, you know, we're in the 30th plus century now. Technology has had to have gotten better. the idea
besides just simply a personal transporter device.
Exactly.
Which, that's the only one I'm still suspect about. I don't know if I like that, but well, because, that's besides the point.
Well, because they just threw that out there without actually giving it some kind of science meat behind it. Here, they gave a little explosion some scientific meat by showing it visually, just watching it. And sometimes that's all you got to do. And they learned that. I remember just watching last season, which I really enjoyed, because I was seeing that their visual effects of the technology, they were legitimately trying to push it and show, okay, we're going to take away, we're not just going to just give some scientific jargon like in dialogue. We have to explain this. You know, it came down to even like improving the holodeck technology where everything was tactile. That was cool. And I'm hoping that basically that I was hoping that basically that little bonus from the last season carried on and in an action sequence. And remember, I've always felt Discovery is not the Star Trek series where action happens. It's usually, hey, let's take a step back. Let's have like a moment. We're supposed to talk it out. not go guns a-blazing.
Yeah. But David, that is something that Discovery has done very well since the very beginning. Setting aside visual effects for a moment, but just the whole cinematic excitement. In fact, one notable aspect of Discovery is its consistent, I guess you can say, aesthetic appeal. From the meticulous mise-en-scene, you know, the compositions to the vibrant color grading, you know, following season three, particular attention specifically has been paid to the Utopian architecture. There's a vast difference between old Federation architecture and then what we have in the 32nd century. It's more prominently vertical and horizontal lines of access.
Yeah.
It's very utopian in design, which that does make sense because we're dealing with a utopian
society.
So even stuff like that has just really cut through for me because I am into the visuals. We don't really get into them as much as we used to just because we'd be sitting here all day when it comes to Discovery, because Discovery has just always been on their A game when it comes to cinematography and the overall compositions and visuals.
Oh yeah, because like that, me and you talked about this in the past with one of the seasons where we were saying when they jumped into the future, this was going to be an interesting take that Star Trek was going to be having to go on, because you can't just say the technology was stagnant, or you can't say that the Federation, the way it looks, is stagnant.
Although you can justify that maybe it's not as advanced as it should be because of the nature of the burn.
Exactly. That was the genius.
Yeah.
As much as me and you did not like that burn storyline how it turned out.
Yeah.
That was a really brilliant, when you look back and you take a step back and you say, okay, let's see how that story beat fits into what they were trying to say. Mm-hmm. That event in the burn is the reason why the Utopian's not all crystal nice and clean. There's a little rough edges to it.
Or why technology isn't exactly where it should be when you take into account 1,000 years
have passed.
Yeah.
And that's why I was like going, okay, I feel bad because back then I was a heavy critic of that. I was actually a heavy critic of like, you know, oh, this thematic visuals that they would do for like Discovery, where it was like, we're supposed to be in a utopia, so everything has to be perfect, but everything looks dirty also. And it was like, for a while I felt, oh man, it feels really inconsistent.
About the third season?
Yeah. It felt inconsistent.
It was just the nature of the setting.
But now that I'm able to actually just take a step back and see it play out, because it goes to like what you said, this is something we have to let cook. We have to let it cook and basically see it to the end. Then we can actually criticize that. And now I'm like you, I'm looking at this, I'm going, okay, I see these little breadcrumbs in the first episode where you're taking everything you've learned from the past seasons and showing us we haven't forgotten. We're going to be pushing it, but we're also showing you, showing that they've kind of mastered that technique.
Okay, so Dave, switching gears just a bit here. Even though the producers themselves and the writers were not aware that this would be, in fact, their final season prior to filming and even wrapped production before they even heard through the grapevine that the series was going to actually come to an end with this upcoming season, the episode did feel like it was wrapping up loose ends and setting up new avenues of exploration in all contexts. Sonequa Martin Green, I believe, had said a similar sentiment in an interview just last week, where she essentially alluded to this idea that there is a finale feel to the fifth season. And she says that's essentially just a happy coincidence because they were all unaware that this would be their last season. Now, they did go back, according to reports, as well as I believe Jonathan Frakes had said this, that they did go back once it was announced and they shot additional things in order to bring the show to a conclusive ending. So we do know that. It's not like they're going to leave us hanging.
Yeah.
Now, when it comes to, you know, setting up these new avenues of exploration, you know, the wrapping up of loose ends, you have the aspects of Saru contemplating his future and his relationship with the Vulcan president of Navarre. Also, the Spore Drive program being shut down and the advent of the Pathway Drive, which we will talk about the Pathway Drive a bit more in a moment because it is a relatively new term and I believe we've only heard it twice. Last season, I believe, was the first time we heard about it. And then, of course, it was front and center in the premiere episode for this season. Now, the myth arc of the season, at least, seems to be is the inclusion of an idea that was introduced in Star Trek: The Next Generation.
A very controversial.
Yeah. Yep. We've actually talked about this a few times through the years because it was a major idea that changed the perception of Star Trek canon and was highly divisive amongst certain religious groups. Because of the nature of what was being explored. And it was this introduction of a species of aliens known as the progenitors who essentially sowed the seeds of all humanoid life in the known universe.
Yes, in the Alpha Quadrant. In the Alpha Quadrant, because they actually had to, they had to go back and explain that they just affected Alpha and Beta Quadrant. Outside of like the Delta Quadrant, no one knows.
Are we sure about that?
Yes, because I had to actually look this up because I was really excited that Discovery would bring this up because this is one of the story beats in TNG that influenced me outside of Star Trek, mm-hmm. where it was like the philosophy of the gods we know are not really gods. I loved that. I love the fact that basically bringing in the questioning religion is just fun to me. When it came down to that story beat where it was like, oh, introducing the progenitors as this alien race that came from a far quadrant, came into the Alpha Quadrant through the Beta Quadrant, and coming to realize that there was no life within our quadrants that was humanoid, like alien life. So what they ended up doing was seeding their DNA throughout the system to see what would happen.
Yeah.
And letting evolution take its effect. And essentially saying that there's no such thing as God in Star Trek.
Yeah. And I also think at that time it didn't come as a surprise to the character. Of course, in canon I'm talking about, because most of the characters in Star Trek have always been conceived as strictly science-based. They are spiritual at times.
Yes.
But spirituality is different than subscribing to a religious doctrine that asserts that there is a
one God,
a being above all else.
Yes.
So when they took that stance in canon, it really didn't do much for the people. They're like, okay, yeah, okay, this is part of our evolution. All right. Now, it was a big deal to find out that all of the major species in the quadrant, the Alpha Quadrant, you are correct. I looked it up. I wasn't sure about that. were in fact all related. Now, also, if you go back to Star Trek Voyager, there's another species as well that's outside of the Alpha Quadrant only because they migrated over the course of a millennia, and it was some lizard species. I don't remember the entire episode, but it was actually the entire episode was presented from the perspective of the alien species, and they were investigating their roots, and they discovered, stumbled upon the Voyager crew in their quadrant, and they realized that they have the same genetic markers. So who knows how far this goes, but the point is that the Discovery writers, they're going to be using, or they have used, the TNG episode, which was titled The Chase, and was the 20th episode of TNG's sixth season. In the episode, essentially Captain Picard discovered a message from a race of ancient aliens known as the Progenitors, who in fact seeded life in the quadrant. And the reason why this is important is because the entire series, presumably, is now shaped around this very small aspect of a single episode of Star Trek.
Because you do the whole thing that makes that episode interesting was the reason behind why the Progenitors did this was they were hoping that basically all the species would realize that they're all related and there would be a massive peace throughout the galaxy. There would be like peace between the races because everyone would realize, hey, we're all the same, essentially the same race.
In a lot of ways, it was an allegory for what Roddenberry was doing with Star Trek. The idea of Star Trek was this vision of unity, that all of humankind would unite together one day for the sake of science, exploration, and the advancement of the human mind condition. And when you look at the nature of these progenitors, that's what they are.
They're
an allegory for Roddenberry and his vision.
And when you look at Discovery as a whole, what is Discovery's theme? Discovery's theme is to actually create that unity, to create, to quote unquote, break social barriers and, you know,
I'll break social barriers with Burnham.
Oh, I would.
Like, what's up, Burnham?
So. I've already stated that majority of the cast, I would break social barriers constantly.
Listen, day one, if I was a showrunner there, I'd be fired for a Me Too violation.
Dude.
All right, guys, it's time. I'm going to do a Justin Timberlake. It's time to bring the sexy back to Star Trek. You're fired. I'm talking about the writers who have no, you know what? I'm not going to get negative. Never mind.
Don't get negative. But the funniest thing by far was the Tilly scene with her being drunk and talking to the guy. I kept like thinking to myself, dude, just take her and ram her into that bed.
No, that's not how things are done anymore. Men are not allowed to be aggressive lovers. Okay. How dare you, potty mouth?
I kept thinking, I don't think he has a penis.
Oh, David, that is very transphobic.
He's not going to hit on her right there. You kidding me?
Are you like a pervert Sebastian from Little Mermaid? You're like, go ahead and fuck the girl.
Fuck the girl. Yes. Yes. I was Sebastian in that scene.
You know you want to. Tilly's sitting across the way. Her titties bounce and sway. Oh, there's no doubt about it.
I'm
going to delete all of this. That is disgusting and completely off tune.
No. It belongs here because we're talking about Discovery.
Okay. All right. So bringing it back, this entire aspect with the Progenitor does appear to be the foundation of the season moving forward.
Yeah.
And the implications of which was brought to a head in the waning moments of the episode. Why is it so dangerous? Why is it so important? Why was it treated so secretive? And essentially because the journal that was discovered that they were going after, that was aboard the Romulan vessel, contains the location of the machinery that the Progenitors used to create life, which one can assume could be used much like the Genesis device.
There you go.
As a weapon. Discovery executive producers Alex Kurtzman and Michelle Paradise have been quite open about the focus of the fifth and final season, where I believe they told a recent blog site, I believe it was Den of Geek, that Burnham and crew will be on a quest, but by tying the object of the quest to the chase, the goal becomes more than a mere MacGuffin. So it isn't simply something to push the plot forward. Because I was a little nervous about that. You know, I'm not a big fan of like plot gimmicks.
Yeah.
Especially with Star Trek. Star Trek has never fucked around with plot gimmicks.
No.
They've always been about just fully developing a narrative. They didn't need gimmicks because they had writing skills to keep audiences entertained, to flesh out characters, to keep people coming back. When TV shows in this modern era resort to gimmicks, which a lot of them do, it's simply because they are not confident in their ability to write an episode from week to week,
yeah,
week or episode to episode. So that's good to hear. That is something I was nervous about, or I should say that was something I was nervous about when they first introduced the progenitor. After I got excited, of course, as a Star Trek nerd, I was like, oh, this is really cool. They're going to tie in this episode. Then I started thinking about it. And of course, from the critic side of things, I was getting a bit nervous because I had assumed or at least thought that it would in fact just be something, some gimmick to tie things or people to Picard, because we know Discovery has floundered a bit when it comes to
the cry of a child,
particular Mike. Star Trek audiences. Well, yes, I'm not. Let's not talk about that. But I was afraid that the use of Jean-Luc Picard's name and this episode was simply a cheap way to drum up excitement. Because what does this also mean with the introduction of the synth and them now also using Alton Soon's name? Are they trying to get us ready for Captain Picard's impending arrival in Discovery's fifth season? We know it is possible that he is in fact alive because of the nature of his death.
Yes.
In the second season of Picard and his resurrection as a synthetic. Ugh, it still sounds
it
so
hurts
stupid.
It hurts your brain, doesn't it?
And I know they had said that, oh, it would age and die like a regular human body. But of course, we know that
was not the case.
Yeah. Now, I'm not saying that's what they're doing, but it did seem like that at first. But then after doing my research and looking for things that Kurtzman and Paradise were talking about pertaining to the promotion of this upcoming season, it's more deeply connected to the series itself,
yeah,
rather than relying on nostalgia and then using nostalgia later down the road to drum up excitement and, you know, headlines.
Well, using this storyline and then throwing it around like those narrative beats, like what you said, like Project Genesis and Soong's name and using the synth technology, it adds gravity to, it gives gravity to the threat. Like, it's not that, that's where the MacGuffin, where I feel that using a MacGuffin, but giving it some gravity to it and basically giving it some plausible, you know, reason why it's there. Suddenly the MacGuffin doesn't become a MacGuffin anymore. And it's an honest to God narrative beat.
Yeah.
And that's why when I look at it, I was like you when they threw around the progenitor thing. I'm like, oh God, you have to explain why this is important. And when you throw in things like the Genesis and you realize that, oh, okay, yeah, progenitor's technology was essentially the Genesis device. But the problem with Genesis was, as all us Star Trek fans know, it wasn't sustainable. When Genesis would go off, the planet would only survive for like 7 days. The progenitor devices lasted forever.
Well, we assume Genesis, I don't think, was designed to create actual humanoid life.
Yeah. It was supposed to create habitable life.
It was a terraforming device, essentially. Yeah. So let's talk about what they gave us in the way of character development or the setting up of our key characters. So there was a bit of a sidelining of various characters, and understandably so, with the nature of this episode and what they were attempting to do and what they did do, I felt, quite correctly, just getting the season going on a high note. It worked. But there were various characters that we can point to that did have some moments. Let's start with Book. a character that we have joked about for quite some time, not because he isn't interesting. He's actually a great addition to the crew or to the cast of Star Trek Discovery, but it was more or less the way they ended his story last season. We had made numerous remarks that it felt weird that you had a character that tried to commit genocide. And the only form of rebuke or punishment, comeuppance, was essentially community service.
Yeah, becoming Burnham's cabana boy.
Yeah, he basically got sentenced to ongoing community service. Now we see what it was more about at the beginning of this episode, and it is more than just simply community service. It's almost like a form of punishment. When he said that I go wherever the Federation points, he's not happy.
Yeah.
Which I was actually satisfied with that, because my biggest problem with Discovery is the lack of repercussions for characters' actions. If I had to point to one thing, that's what it would be.
Yes.
There are no repercussions. Everything ends on a high note, or people get away with the most ridiculous of things. People might point and say, well, Michael, Star Trek did that all the time with Kirk. He did so many things and he never faced repercussions. And I would disagree with that. And I'm not going to go through the history of the movies and the nature of what they were trying to do. They always found ways to allow him to get away with certain things.
Yes.
So I'm not saying he must get away with things, or meaning book, but at least give us a little more other than, oh, it's okay. Because it came off as simply a slap on the wrist at the end of last season. Now we see there's more gravity and weight to his punishment for what he did.
Because essentially his personal freedom has been taken away.
Correct.
And
so much so that he lost his relationship with Burnham.
He doesn't have that ability. Like, I like the fact that they used the relationship of Burnham and Book this time to kind of push the fact that Book is being punished for what he's done.
Yeah.
Where it's kind of like Book wishes to be free. He wishes to be out there with Burnham and having all these adventures. And when he's like telling her, oh yeah, we should have done it like this type of plan that we had back here. And he legitimately almost has this almost prisoner mentality now, where it's like, I'm behind this glass, I can't do anything.
He's a lot more glum. He's not nearly as, which that could also be the fact that he did lose his entire home planet, and that's going
to add that to
leave
it.
An emotional mark for quite some time, but also add to the fact that he's essentially been sentenced and he has lost his relationship with Burnham, someone that he was in love with. I'm also okay with that from the Burnham side. I did like seeing the two of them together. I'm a fan of shipping. I like relationships and shows. I think it can work really well. It hasn't always worked in Star Trek. It hasn't. But the ones that do work really do stand the test of time. Riker, Deanna Troi, Dax and Worf, T'Pol and Tucker, B'Elanna and Paris. They stand the test of time. The ones that do work absolutely work. And that's why it's sad to see Burnham and Book not quite work out, at least at this moment. I'm sure maybe by the end of the season, maybe they'll find themselves again. And that would be an interesting story, actually, and a great way to bring a bit of a finish to Books and Burnham's storyline, because this is the end. And what a great way to send them off, you know, being somewhat happy, because we don't know if we're ever going to see Burnham again.
Yeah.
Discovery isn't the most popular Star Trek series, and once it goes dark, it's probably over. Now, we also have Saru, which was probably the biggest change, I would say, of the crew so far, because you have a character that has now decided to forgo his passion of being a part of Starfleet, and he wants to become an ambassador for the Federation so that he can be closer to his, I guess, would-be wife now.
Yeah, his significant other.
Or his soon-to-be wife, his significant other, the Vulcan president. It is an awkward pairing, but I do like the sentiment, and I like Saru, and he is such, the actor that plays Saru, I always forget his name, is so convincing. No matter what you give him, he makes it work.
Yes. This one, this is the one that basically I feel like the last, I think it was last season or the season before, where Saru left because of, I can't even remember the character's name that caused the burn, but the, when he left the Federation for that character, that felt hammer fisted and it felt like, what the heck was going on here? I think this is like a,
his name was Sukal. I only remember that because I hate him.
But like,
you make this, me happy.
You make me happy.
What is he, Ben Stiller?
But this, in regards to this, at least when he makes this decision to leave the Federation because he wants to have an outside life outside of the Federation now, that makes sense to me. The way they played it here is night and day compared to how they did tried to do it with the Sukal thing, where he wanted to take care of Sukal. Why?
Yeah, I will. Even though I didn't like the Sukal thing, it does make sense for a character like Saru, because if you look at a brief snapshot of his history and Discovery from the very beginning, what has he been about? He's been about searching for a connection, a family, a familial connection. He was upset with Burnham's relationship, or jealous of Burnham's relationship with Georgiou, because he wanted Georgiou to be his family. Then he bonded with Burnham. Then he bonded with Sukal.
I like how you kind of get that disappointment.
One of the worst characters in Star Trek of all time is Sukal. I don't give a fuck who's listening. I'm sorry. It was the worst.
Mike, it's his cry as a child.
Let's not get into negative. This is the final season of Discovery and I want to enjoy myself. Let's not bring up old shit. But it does make sense. If you look at his character, it does make sense for him to make a decision like this, because he's always made very important decisions through the lens of familial desires, wanting to connect with someone.
Well, look at even like his decision about with his sister.
Yeah, exactly.
That was a big one too.
Yeah.
And it was kind of like this one in particular makes so much better sense because of how they portrayed it.
Yeah, I do dig Saru and what is her name? Terrell? Is that her name?
I think
you don't need to worry about looking it up, but I do like their relationship. It is a bit awkward, but I do like that. I like the two of them both.
Yes.
And I think that's why, even though it's awkward, I'm okay with it.
But the awkwardness goes to like what me and you have talked about, is like, this is the awkward that we expect out of Discovery. Discovery is a series that for some strange reason, relationships have to be awkward. Even with Burnham and Book. Burnham and Book is like, for some strange reason, there's moments when they have to be awkward.
Yeah, but that I think is built into the narrative. I don't think it has anything to do with chemistry per se. I think what you're talking about is a chemistry issue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But like, I'm really hoping that basically we get to see Saru and the Vulcan ambassador, Vulcan president, kind of like their relationship grow.
Yeah. I'm sure that's what they're going to be doing. If this is our final season and everyone behind the scenes is saying that it feels like an ending, I'm sure it's going to feel just fine. Now, I will say, David, one particular character that I'm really happy with is the magnificent, triumphant foil of Burnham. Captain Rayner.
Why am I not surprised?
God bless Star Trek Discovery for casting Callum Keith Rennie, I believe is his name.
Yeah.
First off, super big fan of that guy's work. That guy is just, he's an underrated talent that has never gotten credit. I swore after his run on Battlestar Galactica in the mid-2000s that he was going to be the next big thing. He was so damn good. He has so much screen presence. There's so much fucking swagger and gravitas to his performances.
He's an old school actor.
Yeah, I really dig him. And the fact that they're pairing him up with Burnham, I'm going to tell you now, David, this is what the show has been missing. Discovery, in a lot of ways, is the most touchy-feely Star Trek series we've ever been given. I'm not saying that's a negative. That's just a fact. Voyager veered into that area because of the nature of that series being isolated on their own, cut off from everyone, they were the only family they had. So them doing that and that real, but even that show wasn't touchy feely. It was more intimate, not a lot of professionalism sometimes between the crews because it was also their home and their family. Discovery needs a character like Rayner. He's a foil. He's someone that's going to challenge Burnham.
He's what's missing from Burnham.
He is the act. He is an ingredient that's been missing. We need someone to challenge Burnham who's not touchy-feely. That's not all about her. Someone who hasn't drank the Burnham Kool-Aid.
Think about it like this. The times that we've seen Burnham flourish is when
she's given
a challenging, I put this in parentheses, authority figure that basically will keep her in check or challenge the way she thinks.
Emperor Georgiou was a lot like that. That's why when she left the show, I was so disappointed, not because the character was so interesting, but because she was the perfect narrative tool to help you shape your protagonist that much better.
Or heck, look at the other characters that have kind of fit that mold.
Yeah.
That she's been missing. When Pike came on, Pike showed Burnham what a true captain should be.
Yeah, but he also wasn't antagonistic. And I think sometimes you need that type of character to poke you in the ribs so that we can, it's a writing trick that helps audiences understand characters better.
Yeah.
You create friction, not animosity. We don't need drama.
No.
But just a friction there, because then it allows the character themselves a justified introspection.
Yes.
To wonder if they're doing the right thing. That's the whole purpose of a foil in writing. And Rayner seems to be that character. Now, I have seen reports that he's not just showing up for one episode. He is a permanent fixture in the final season.
I hope so. I really do. After this episode, I'm like going, I want more of Rayner, because he is, for me, what Jason Isaacs was to Burnham from season one.
It's a little different, but I get what you're saying.
It's kind of like that figure that basically keeps Burnham on her toes.
There you go. Yeah.
But the difference between him and like a Jason Isaacs character is like, I really think Burnham and Rayner could literally legitimately be a great pairing as two captains together, kind of like how Picard has Riker.
Or even Admiral Kirk and Captain Spock.
Yeah, Kirk and Spock. Rayner, what he did, my favorite scene is when he basically is listening to all their math and trying to figure out, oh no, what about this scenario? What about this scenario? And then out of the blue, he basically says, hooray for 70%. And I'm like going, he has a point. 70% is better than less than that.
He's an asshole right now, but that's purposefully done. And I get what they're trying to do. I really hope he stays.
I do.
Right in center.
I hope they don't do something saying, like turn him. Don't turn him. He has to be kind of like a permanent fixture.
I don't mind. Yeah. I don't mind if he eventually comes to see eye to eye with Burnham. I think that's the nature of Star Trek, you know, unifying people's perspectives by the end. But I want him to continue as that antagonistical element that does in fact keep Burnham on her toes. Okay. Tilly. We already talked about her a bit. Wait, did we talk? Or was that our pre-show?
I think that was our pre-show.
So Tilly, they found a creative way to bring Tilly back into the show. I know they removed her for most of season four because of the character aspect that they
built in
halfway through season four, where Tilly essentially decides that
captainship is not for her.
Yeah, becoming the captain or becoming a captain is not really her thing. The command trek is something possibly that is not something that is aligned with her goals any longer. And she realized that her true passion was
teaching.
Was teaching over at the newly reopened Starfleet Academy. And a lot of us had figured, okay, well, this means that she's being taken out of this show and she will be the lead for Starfleet Academy when that comes out, which is in fact a direct spinoff of Star Trek Discovery. That remains to be seen. We get into detail about that during our recent pre-show over on Patreon. You can go to patreon.com/Rain Man Digital and subscribe to gain access to that discussion. We go into great detail about Tilly and where her future may or may not be when it comes to Star Trek. But it does seem like that they found a creative way to keep Tilly's involvement, Mary Wiseman's character, involved in the rest of the season. And I want that, because Mary Wiseman's Tilly has been one of the wonderful delights of this series.
Yes.
She's been consistently entertaining, and not to have her in the final season would feel strange.
Would feel really off.
Yeah. So I'm glad they're bringing her back, and apparently she will be here for the rest of the season. And then we have Kovich.
Kovich is like, last season, Kovich became like my favorite character. Not just because, you know, like he's portrayed by one of my favorite, you know, filmmaking icons, but but like the whole idea of Kovich is also kind of like Rayner. He brings that element that keeps the Discovery crew on their toes. The one thing I love about Kovich is kind of like he almost brings almost like a parallel mirror to the optimistic viewpoint of the Discovery crew, where math wins all and hooray for science.
He is strictly a man of science.
Yes.
His religion is science.
Yeah.
His stoic demeanor comes from a place of science. This man is a serious individual. I find him very interesting.
Yeah.
I think part of that interest, though, is the mystique that surrounds the character. We don't know anything about him, and I don't think that's a writing error. That's purposely done, and I'm hoping we find out something big about him before this season comes to an end. Like, I believe the rumor for years now, since he was introduced, has been that he's the real leader of Section 31.
Oh, dude. Ever since we covered it, there have been some outlandish but fun rumors about Kovich. I think the one rumor I read online was like he's apparently like a version of the Guardian of Forever.
Oh, that, see, dude, I don't.
And it would make sense.
If they do it right, it could be interesting. Anything could work with this character because of how much mystique they've sewed into the character's DNA at this point.
Yeah.
I mean, all we know about him is that he's some scientist doctor for the Federation.
And
he's not even a member of Starfleet.
Yeah, and he's just obsessed with, I don't know, solving the mysteries of the universe.
He was, I think they said that he was an expert in the alternate realities.
Alternate realities.
I believe, I don't quote me on that, but I believe that's how they introduced him originally in season 3.
Yeah.
So Kovich was front and center this episode. I'm hoping they bring him back. I hope it's a recurring. All right, so let's talk about the pathway drive before we close out. It's a relatively new Star Trek concept. The pathway drive was an experimental, faster than light propulsion system developed by the United Federation of Planets in the late 32nd century to lessen their dependence on dilithium in 3190. The prototype pathway drive was to be installed in the USS Voyager for testing.
Yes.
And the newly inaugurated Federation president was evaluating candidates for the captaincy. And then we saw that last season. In 3191, the Federation opted to pursue the pathway drive over the spore drive. That year, Captain Rayner, I'm not going to get into spoilers.
Yeah, don't go into spoilers. There's spoilers right there.
So that's the background. It's only been mentioned twice in Star Trek Discovery.
Well, I especially like how it was used in this, where it's not just the throwaway line, but also it helped characters' narratives. Like, the one thing that I took out of this episode that I actually like was Stamets. Like, the fact that basically Stamets, his character arc now is about legacy. He's worried that basically, all of his work on the spore drive is getting tossed aside for the pathway drive.
Yeah.
And
well, they got to get the spore drive's too easy.
Yeah.
Do you remember I said this when Discovery first premiered? I remember you and I discussed the spore drive at great lengths. it's a really cool concept. Fantastic, I know some people shitted on it and said that the whole mycelial network was stupid, but read about spores and fungus and the idea of this interconnected vast mycelial network is literally based on what is underneath our feet while we're talking right now.
Yes.
Fungus is interconnected. And there was a recent study that was done by someone that was following up on the work of the scientist Stamets, which is the character in Star Trek is named after the scientist who has pushed these theories forward when it comes to the mycelial network. There was a recent report that they believe fungus is far more alive and possibly conscious because of the way it interacts with each other.
Yes.
So it's not a stupid idea. It's an amazing idea, but that's besides the point. I had said the spore drive is cool, but it is a slippery slope. And I said before the show ends, they're going to have to find a way to get rid of it.
Yes.
It makes traveling the stars far too easy.
Oh, yeah. It beats warp drive technology.
It takes away everything that's cool about the exploration of space. You just can't do it outside of the confines of a season or a run of a Star Trek series like Discovery. It's worked. They've made it work so far every season. But now that the show's coming to an end, I feel like it's time to put it away.
Yeah. Just narratively, I understand. I understand that basically they have to get rid of, because the spore drive in itself is the biggest MacGuffin in that started and Discovery.
It's not a MacGuffin.
Well, it's one of those character, the narrative beats that they introduced that I'm like going,
the MacGuffin in that season was Ash Tyler and his entire fucking story arc.
But like with the spore drive, it is a very dangerous narrative tool for Star Trek because you start questioning the science at that point. And not the science behind the spore drive, but how the science interacts with the universe. Like you start questioning, well, if they had spore drive technology, why did they not use it during this time and this time and this time? But it just like what you said, it removes that romanticism of Star Trek of exploring. In the world would we want to explore if all we have to do is use the mycelial network and just in a brief second we're there?
Yeah.
Correct. It kind of ruins the whole idea behind Star Trek.
Yeah.
And that's why I was like going, I understand why they have to remove it, but I also want them to remove it not in a kind of like a, we're going to sweep it under the rug. Have it make sense for some characters. Use it as a character narrative.
Right. And I do hope they give us a little bit more on why they have chosen to go with the pathway drive over the spore drive. I hope this isn't the only bit we hear. Like, all right, guys, they're going to be closing shop down. And then here we are waiting the rest of the season for some additional story to beef up that explanation a bit more, to give it some more oomph, and we don't get it. That would suck. So I'm hoping that they didn't just give us what we needed in this past episode. And then that's it. You know, let's call it a day, guys. All right, David. So overall, I enjoyed the first episode of season 5. I thought it was a great way to start the episode. Lots of excitement, intrigue. I am locked in and I'm ready to see what happens this season. I'm going to go with an 85% for the first episode. What are your final thoughts, David, and your RMD score?
I'm going to surprise you because I actually had this written down at a higher score than you.
Oh, really?
Because I thought that basically it's been a while since we got to cover Discovery and you usually lead the charge for it. But this one, this episode, I was left really excited where the series could go.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that there wasn't many character narrative loose ends that were like just dangling in the episode. Like, unfortunately, the Discovery in the earlier seasons did a little trying to find their footing. Here, I'm seeing like really great progress. They know what they're doing at this point. I like where they're going. And I actually ended up giving this an 89, which is like 4 points more than you, which I was really surprised with. I thought you were going to go with a 90 on it. But like, that's why I was like going, I'm really excited for where they're going. It's going to be interesting to see, okay, will this, is this going to be a season wide story arc that we're going to do with the progenitors? Or is it just like what me and you have talked about in the past, where they're going to be cutting back on like more, less serialized and more episodic, where it's going to only be like one or two episodes?
I'm only afraid, because they're trying to change the tone, that they don't go as deep as they have.
Yeah.
And they offer us more superficial stories. Strange New Worlds, even though I really enjoy that show and there are some excellent episodes, and overall the season is just really great, because of the nature of how they're writing those shows, those episodes, and how short the season is, the episodic and the shortened season doesn't work well together so far, in my opinion, for Strange New Worlds. There's just not enough there by the time you get to the end. I'm hoping they don't turn Discovery into that, because the saving grace for Discovery has been its deep dissection of character.
Yeah.
Well, I know people say, well, the Burnham show. Well, at least Burnham and the surrounding characters that matter to her development. All right. On that note, David, let's end the show. I want to thank everyone for listening, and thank you, Dave.
Thank you. Live long and prosper.
I couldn't help but notice your pain.
My pain?
It runs deep. Share it with me.
End simulation.